So it feels a little awkward today because the parsha, the Aliyah, the parsha in general, but the third Aliyah of Achrimos focuses on Yom Kippur. So it feels a little funny speaking about Yom Kippur right before Pesach. I don't think there is anything you saw that I know of that Pesach Kippurim, Pesach Yom Kippurim. I don't know if there's any vort like that to make, but sorry? Yeah, we don't have so much synergy, but to whatever extent it's possible to draw connections, so we'll do what we can. But so that's what we have for the parsha. So we'll spend maybe just a few minutes discussing some of the Yom Kippur and Yanim that are alluded to in the third Aliyah. Maybe not that long, and then we'll try to go to a little bit more about Pesach with some questions that were asked yesterday. I mentioned I want to come back a little bit more about Pesach and Nisa, so we'll try to address all those things in the time that we have. Hi.
I was just going to say, I think some Rishonim draw the connection between Pesach and Yom Kippur by virtue of the fact that it's a time period where something that's normally mutter is not allowed to eat.
In terms of the achronish issue of whether there is a
achronish issue.
Well, no, I'm just zeroing in on one point of it, so maybe I'll let you say what you're saying.
I don't know. I was just throwing something out there.
Well, there is an interesting question in general that the Achronim talk about whether something can be called inherently usur, whether the concept of an isur chefta can apply to something which is only temporarily permitted. That's a little bit synergy as far as our whole isur malacha that we've been talking about all year, that the position that we've mentioned at the beginning of the semester, the beginning of last semester also, that Shabbos, the prohibition, is about the individual doing the malacha and not so much about the malacha itself. So Rav Yosef Engel, when he disagrees with that position, but the way he expresses it is that since a malacha is only temporarily prohibited, 6 days a week you're allowed to do malacha. So you can't tell me that Zriya and Bishul and Hotzah are bad things. They must not be inherently bad. It must be there's only a prohibition on the individual to do them because they're temporary yisurim. So he happens not to like that yisod, but that yisod would seem to say, for example, that when it comes to chametz on Pesach, so chametz wouldn't be perceived as an isur chavtza because it's only temporarily usur, and eating on Yom Kippur would seemingly also not be perceived as an isur chavtza because how could you say that all the food in the world all of a sudden is usur b'chavtza one day a year and then the rest of the year it's mutter? Those who feel that can't be true. It's interesting. I thought there was maybe a little of a riot to that yisod from the Daf Yomi of the past week. So some of the Gemaras recently in Daf Yomi talk about the klal of Davar Sheyesh Lo Matirin, that if you have something which is only usur for now but will later become mutter, so it's not subject to bittul. You can't be mevatel. So Rashi says in Beitza and Daf Gimel that the reason you can't be mevatel it, it sounds like, because why should you? It'll be mutter later, so why get involved with bittul when you can have it beheter later? And the Ran in Maseches Nedarim and Daftin Beis, the Ran understands that the issue is that bittul is not going to work because bittul requires a real clash, a clash of Issur beheter. And if something is Davar Sheyesh Lo Matirin, it's only a quasi-Isser, so to speak. It's not fully labeled Isser, so the difference between the Mutter and the Isser is not so absolute. You don't really have enough of a clash in order to create Bittul. So I was wondering if maybe that Ran might be a Raya for this Yisod, that maybe what the Ran is essentially saying is that if something's only temporarily Isser, it's Isser for now, but it'll be Mutter later. So that's not called Isser. The item is not a Cheptishal Isser. So you can't say that it's clashing with Heter to have Bittul, because there's no Isser in the item anyway. The temporary Isser reflects an Isser Gavra rather than an Isser Chavtza. But in any event, I appreciate the attempt. So basically, you could link together Pesach and Yom Kippur through the idea they both involve Isurim of Achila, which are temporary. Okay, we'll take that. So on that note, let's just say a few words about the concept of Yom Kippur, specifically the ideas that are addressed in Shlishi. Just say a few of them, and then we'll move on to Pesach. So, first of all, towards the middle, Pasuk Chavtes over here. So, after telling us about all of the avoda, the beginning of Achrimos, So then the Torah says, V'haysa lahem l'chukas olam b'chodesh ha'shvi b'asor l'chodesh, etc. So there is an observation, it happens to be Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shamshon Rafael Hirsch both make similar comments on this pasuk, that things are a little bit backwards, that normally if the Torah is going to tell us about a korban that has to be brought at a certain time, so it'll first tell us, okay, here's the date, here's what's happening, and now bring the korban that's necessary for that day. So the idea that at the end of the whole process the Torah is highlighting the date seems a little bit backwards. So both the Rav Moshe and the Rav Hirsch both make this observation, and they answer along similar lines, a different way, but basically along the same idea, the Torah wants to de-emphasize the idea that the Avoda is the source of the Kapara, that the Kapara is not from the Avoda is something you have to do on Yom Kippur, but the identity of Yom Kippur as a day of Kapara is not because of the Avoda. And you might have thought that if the Torah is in the layout, okay, here's Yom Kippur, it's a day of Kapara, here's what you do, so then one might get the impression that the Kapara comes through the Avoda. Then, at that point, they diverge a little bit. Rav Moshe writes that maybe the Kapara itself comes through the Kohen's appearance in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, that that type of desire to experience closeness to God in a very focused fashion, that itself is the source of the Kapara. And the Avodah is the Makshir, so to speak. That's what we do in order to allow that to take place. Rav Hirsch focuses on the fact that the Shvisa Mei Melacha, and the Shvisa Mei Eating, the Inui, so to speak, that's really where the Kapara comes from, together with Tshuva. The Korbanos are not as integral to the process, and that's also tied into the fact that here the Torah says Chukas Olam, meaning that there's always going to be Yom Kippur, it's always going to be possible, and we don't always have a Beis HaMikdash, and setting aside the concept of Neshama Parim Sfaseinu, which certainly is a major element on Yom Kippur, because we certainly do incorporate that into our tefillah service as much as possible, but still, at the end of the day, we don't have the Beis HaMikdash. So the Chukas Olam refers to the other components of Yom Kippur, the fasting and the Shvisa Mimelacha and the Tshuva. So that's really what it's about. So one should not get the impression that it's the Korbanos that bring about the Kapar. He also comments, Rav Hirsch, on this pasuk. It's interesting. So I mentioned that. So I have the Rav Hirsch in English. Which itself, the Hebrew is also a translation, he wrote originally in German, so the English, Hebrew, whatever it is, it's a translation. So it's interesting, here he has a point specifically about the English, which you have to read it in English to understand, that he notes that the translation of Ta'anu is an important concept to understand, that the Gemara says, Beferish, that Inu Yom Yom Kippur is only passive, that one shouldn't think that, okay, maybe appreciate this, especially this year, that okay, maybe if I'm supposed to afflict myself on Yom Kippur, so I should go sit out in the snow, or I should go seek out the very cold weather, or I should go seek out the very hot weather, maybe I should try to make myself miserable on Yom Kippur. And the Gemara understands that no, that that's not the what Inui means. Inui means that we abstain from things that bring us pleasure, but not that we seek to actively hurt ourselves. We're not going to whip ourselves on Yom Kippur, we're not going to stab ourselves or sit on a hot fire. That's not what it's about. And to that extent, it parallels Shvisa in terms of Shvisa Mimelacha. Now, the Rambam uniquely labels the section of Halachos of Yom Kippur Shvisa Ta'asor, that the whole day is a day of Shvisa, Shvisa Mimelacha, Shvisa from eating, and that is by its nature passive. So therefore, says Rav Hirsch, the translation that you find in English of Inui as affliction is inaccurate, because as he notes, and again, I don't know what this looks like presented in any other language, but he notes this in English, that affliction is not the way to say it, because it comes from the Latin affliger, which means pain and suffering, and that's not what it's about. So here is your synergy to Pesach, bingo, because the Achronim want to know, the Mechasinach and others, that we have a mitzvah of Tashbisu on Pesach. So what does Tashbisu mean? Does Tashbisu mean specifically that we should do something to get rid of chametz, that we have an active mitzvah to get rid of the chametz? Or does it mean that No, that we should be free of chametz. So if we don't have chametz, so that is tashbisu. So the Achronim talk about this at length. There's a Minchas Chinuch about this in Mitzvah Tes. The Avin Ezer has Shuvos about this. There's a nice essay about this in the Sefer Koch VeYitzchak, where they discuss, and Sefer Merapu and Nefesh, he has a nice essay about this question about, is this comparable to tashbisu, the Lashon of Teshbistu by Chametz, is that the same Lashon like we have of Shabbos and Shvisa Sa'asr? So that's your connection. That it's just like Shvisa Sa'asr is all about passive abstention, so we don't eat and we don't do malacha, but it's not about anything active in that definition. So too, the word Teshbistu in the context of Pesach, what does it mean? So sometimes that's invoked in the question of, is there an Indian davka to have chametz on Erev Pesach so that you can mekayim teshbisu actively? Or do you say that, no, if you don't have chametz at all, so ein lecha teshbisu garo mizah, there's no Indian to have chametz specifically so you can destroy it. So some of the Achronim say that whole question doesn't really mean that somebody should go out of the way to obtain chametz. It means that if somebody has chametz, then maybe the mitzvah of teshbisu is shayach, and if you don't, then it's not shayach. Okay, then you don't have any obligation. So that's a whole discussion. The Minchas Chinuch has a couple of nafkaminas. As for example, let's say you're going to destroy your chametz on Erev Pesach, and just before you're about to do it, you're about to burn your chametz, so somebody shows up with a flamethrower and zaps your chametz before you get a chance to. So he basically took away your beer chametz. So the Gemara says in Chulin that if somebody takes away your mitzvah, if you're about to do a bris milah on your son and somebody comes over and says, oh, 8-day-old baby, and he's malhim, so he has to pay you for that. He stole your mitzvah opportunity. It's called Sarah Zehuvim. He has to pay for that ganav of the mitzvah. So the Minchas Chinuch says, so let's say somebody comes and chops your chametz before you get a chance to. So can you charge him a Sarah Zehuvim? It's a new definition of Mechiras Chametz, right? So you'll profit off the chametz. So he thought it was totally on this question, that is there a mitzvah to get rid of chametz? Or do you say that no, that chametz is all about not having it? So tashbisu means you simply should be in a state of no chametz possessing. So fine, so you've done that. So there's no Indian, there's nothing you lost by having somebody else do the destroying for you. It's also a discussion, they might call this the Blavi Yitzchak or Berdichev Nafkamina. Now, let's say somebody eats chametz on Pesach, so he's going to be in trouble in Shemayim. So when it comes time for his din on Yom Kippur, here's again the synergy. So when on Yom Kippur, they're being done him for having eaten on Pesach. So you have the defending angels and the opposing angels. So the prosecuting angel will say, he ate on Pesach. So the defending angel will be able to say, yes, but at least he was mekayim teshbisu. Right, could you say that if you ate the chametz, so you got rid of it, so that's a kiyum tashbisu. So does tashbisu just mean you should be in an absence of chametz, so then there's nothing really to be too proud of that you ate chametz on Pesach? Or did you say at least that there's a mitzvah to get rid of the chametz, so there's something there? It's not really a very strong defense, but at least there'll be something to say, all right, you know, at least there was a kiyum mitzvah at the same time.
So
the yeah, it's got a lot of problems with it. But we have at least something to be able to, again, this is very much not advised. Definitely to think that this is going to be your excuse for getting chametz on Pesach is not advocated. But is there any kind of kiyum mitzvah at all, anything to that you're very Berdichevian defense angel will be able to schlep out? So that's part of the things, that's part of the issue that the Minchas Chinuch talked about. So that does tie into this concept, that's this observation of Rav Hirsch, that Inui is similar to Shvisa, and Shvisa, the meaning of Shvisa, which is the root of the word Tashbisu, all of that ties into this question. Okay, so then we'll just say a little bit about this next pasuk, which is the central pasuk really identifying what Yom Kippur is all about, Aki B'yom Hazeh, that here the Torah tells us that the essence of Yom Kippur is defined to this fashion. The pasuk says, "Ki b'yom hazeh yechaper aleichem letahir eschem mikol chatoseichem lefnei Hashem titar." So first of all, so how is that pasuk to be read? So as the Sfarim point out, there's an asnachta under the word eschem. So it means that pause there. So ki b'yom hazeh yechaper aleichem letahir eschem. Stop there. So mikol chatoseichem lefnei Hashem titaru. So that could be as the Rambam and Rabbeinu Yonah understand, that there's a specific mitzvah of tshuva on Yom Kippur. There's a mitzvah of tshuva in general. Pashtus is, Parshas Nitzavim tells us, is a mitzvah of tshuva of Vishavtem al Hashem Elokecha. There are those who dispute that, who think that it's more of a nevuah, that ultimately we will do tshuva, because the language of the Rambam, where the Rambam begins Hilchos Tshuva, so he says that the mitzvah is, when one wants to do tshuva, so he should be mitzvadin, he should do vidui. So there are some who read that Rambam to say there's no mitzvah of tshuva, there's only mitzvah of vidui. Rav Soloveitchik at length in his shiurim explains why he doesn't think that that's at all the case. But Pashtus is the Pasuk in Chumash, there's a chiyuv of tshuva in general. And in addition to that, so some of the Rishonim said there's a specific obligation of tshuva on Yom Kippur, which is related to the question that Bali Musa asked. The Bali Musa say that if Aseres made tshuva, the whole thing is about shifting the balance, that we assume that we're all Beinonim, that we all have half Averis and half Mitzvah, so we need the Aseres made tshuva to tilt things. So why do we have Aseres made tshuva? Let's have Aseres made Mitzvah. Just do some Mitzvahs during that time, and that will tilt the balance if you're 50-50. So do some mitzvahs, and that will push you over. So why is it you have to do tshuva? It's harder to do tshuva than to do other mitzvahs. Just do other mitzvahs. That will also get you with a rove. So some of the Bali Musa explain, I think Rabbi Tzla Petterberger has like this, that the chiyuv of tshuva is intensified on this time of year. It's also the pasuk in Sefer Yeshaya, Dirshu Hashem Behimatzo, Karoba Hisokarov, that you should call out to God when He's close. And the Gemara says, Elu Aseres Yomim Shebein Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, during Aseres Mei Tshuva, God is especially close. So the Bali Musar have this idea that to not do tshuva during Aseres Mei Tshuva is especially egregious. That's going to set your balance off by too much. It's not simply a question of get rid of some Averis so you'll come out ahead. It's that there's a specific obligation of tshuva during this time, that if you're going to ignore that, you're going to be missing a tremendous amount. So similarly, the Rishonim say the Yom Kippur has a chiyuv of tshuva itself, and that could be read in this pasuk, if you say there's an asnachta in the middle. So then it's saying that the obligation is on you to be mitar yourself, and that's a special chiyuv for Yom Kippur. In general, this double language of tahara and kapara that you find in the pasuk, so many of the Bali Musar, many of the Achronim discuss, this is also a concept that Rav Soloveitchik spoke about at length in his tshuva shiurim, that there's two separate ideas, there's tshuva and there's kapara and there's tahara is mentioned in this pasuk, that the kapara is the atonement for the avera, but the avera also has an effect on the soul, we say by kashrus, has a timtum halev, it messes up your neshama, so therefore you need to also have that removed. So that's the idea of tahara, and the special beauty of Yom Kippur is that it affects all those things, it affects the kapara for the avera, and also the effect of the avera is taken away. That's the idea of tahara. And Rav Hirsch also notes, in saying a similar idea, that so this idea of Lefnei Hashem, the pasuk is telling us that this is the special school of Yom Kippur, that even if you want to say, okay, so when it comes to outwardly religious ideas, so Akash Baruch Hu should say, all right, so we have the right to have a chiddush of a mitzvah of tshuva, and that therefore your averus are fixed through tshuva. But when it comes to the external effect, that's a little bit more about the practical world. So you might say, okay, so how if I could do tshuva, so how does that change the practical effect on my soul that averus have had? So Akash Baruch Hu was saying, listen, I'm God, I control the world. And Lefnei Hashem, in front of God's eyes, all of this is going to take place, that there will be a kapara, there will be a tahara, that everybody is going to be able to fix themselves completely through this process of Yom HaKippurim. It's a beautiful idea. So the Gemara also understands from this pasuk that there is an obligation of bakashas mechila, that one is obligated to ask mechila from anyone who he has done something wrong to, and that the pasuk is saying that we have an obligation, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I will be mochel you to a certain extent, but you still have to do something. So it says the Mishnah in the end of Yuma, that Yom Kippur is not mechaper unless one gets mechila from the people who he has done wrong to. So we've talked about this in the past, we spoke about this in the Beis Medrash earlier in the year, the Tshuva Drasha this year. So we'll just mention some highlights of that chiyuv. Won't go into it at length at all, because we have spoken about it a number of times. But it seems to be that the idea of tshuva through ben adam l'chaveru, the idea of bakashas mechila from others, as it is tied into the kapara of Yom HaKippurim, we could explain in three ways. This is the way that we find it discussed in Svarim, that there probably are at least three points of focus. Now, on the one hand, there is the idea that the person who you hurt, your victim, has a claim against you, that he has a taina on you, and he could press charges, so to speak. So just like in secular law, sometimes if you commit a crime against the victim, if it's not that serious, so there is the opportunity for the victim to not press charges. It's up to him to decide whether he wants to bring the case or not. So therefore, you maybe have a similar idea here also, that the victim has to drop the claim, otherwise they'll be in trouble. Kadosh Baruch Hu says, listen, I can be mochel, your victim's still going to press charges. So you need to have the claim dropped. Others understand that that's not the whole story, especially because we find that many Achron and Paskin, they arise from the Gemara like this, that if somebody is mochel and you don't ask him for mechila, that's not enough. You still have to ask for the mechila. So the poskim talk about, let's say, for example, somebody is makbid to say the tefillah zaka before Yom Kippur. The Chayadim wrote a tefillah called the tefillah zaka, where you do a number of accomplishments, but one of them is that you declare that you're mochel anybody who has hurt you. If they owe you money, you still want the money, but any other issue, you're mochel them. So some of the poskim said, so maybe you should, if you want to be efficient in your bullying of people, you should make sure only to pick on people who you know say tefillah zaka. So you don't have to ask them for mechila because they'll declare this before Yom Kippur. Or the Gemara says that Rav Zeira used to say when he went to sleep at night, as they have in Kriya Shema Lamita, that he forgives everyone who ever causes him problems that day. So maybe he should get picked on more because people know they don't have to spend time asking for mechila because he does it automatically. So for the most part, most of the poskim assume that no, it doesn't work, that it's good that that individual does that, but as far as your obligation, you still have to ask for mechila. So what's pshat? So it seems to be that the asking of mechila is not really a means to an end, but it's really a part of the process. Like they say that joke about yeshiva guys, that the yeshiva guys know that if you put sugar in the coffee and you stir the coffee, so the coffee becomes sweet. But they're not sure, is it the sugar that makes it sweet, or maybe it's the stirring. And you just need the sugar in order to tell you when to stop stirring. So when the sugar dissolves, you know when to stop stirring. So you could ask the same question here, is it the mechila that gets you off the hook, or is it the bakashas mechila? And that when he gives you mechila, so you know that you've asked properly. So it might be that it's actually the bakashas mechila. So what's the point of that? So the point seems to be, on the one hand, there are those who suggest that it's a submissive process. The person who was so haughty and was so arrogant that he was willing to treat others disrespectfully and to sin against other people, so if he now has to submit to them, he has to ask for them to come and forgive him. So then that itself is a kapara. That itself is part of tshuva. And the Gemara says in Maseches Brachos, that kol ha'over averu mispayesh, if somebody does an averu and he regrets it, mochlum lo al kol ha'venosa. So that sounds like a little bit too much. You could say if you're embarrassed for an averu, so you get kapara for that averu. But you're forgiven for all your averus. So this is a point Rav Shlomo Worman, Zichrono Livracha, talks about in one of his svarim, that you could say that yes, because the busha is a part of the kapara process, so going through that is itself a chelek in tshuva. So if that's the case, so then that could explain why there's a chiyuv of bakashas mechila, that that's a part of the process, and it's not even defined by what the other guy does. The other guy is forgiving of you is just an indication that you've gone through the process properly. A third way to understand it is that the notion of asking for mechila is in order to repair relationships. That the Medrash says that when Yom Kippur comes, so one of the arguments that's advanced on our behalf is that we are angelic, we act like angels, so we don't eat, we don't drink, and the angels are at peace with each other, so too the Jews are at peace with each other. So apparently part of how we obtain kapara is through creating one unit that's not fighting. So if we have tensions between people, so in order to be able to get a kapara, we have to smooth those over. We have to be able to be, in the language of the Gemara, then achei ratze es chaveru, that you have to be able to appease the person. You have to be able to calm him down. So that's a whole discussion, how exactly you understand the purpose of Mechila. Is it so that you get the claim dropped? Is it so that you go through a somewhat embarrassing and therefore purifying experience? Or is it that you fix relationships so that we'll be considered to be one unit and we'll be able to have the special kapara of Yom HaKippurim? The Chassam Sofer says in his drashes that in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, so there was less of a need for Mechila, that the Beis HaMikdash was a unifying force that brought everyone together. So asking Mechila was not so important. But now we don't have the Beis HaMikdash to bring us together, so asking for Mechila is a bigger deal, which puts a little bit of a different perspective than what we said before about whether the Karbanos are part of the Kapar or not. So whatever brought the Jews together, maybe that's a part of the Kapar. And the Chukas Olam, then we have Mechila now to try to make sure that we're all one unit. So Reb Simcha Zissel Broi, the Rashi from Chevron in the Sefer Sam Derech, so he wanted to suggest a little bit differently, that he said that there really are two makoros that you find in Chazals telling us you have to ask for Mechila, and they quote different psukim. That there's a Mishnah in Bava Kamma, in the 8th parak of Bava Kamma, in parak HaChovel. So there the Mishnah says that if you ask, if you hurt somebody, if you wound somebody, so you have to pay. That's all the restitution the Torah talks about. And you have to ask the guy for Mechila. And it quotes a Pasuk that you have to ask for Mechila. And then there's the Mishnah in Yuma that we mentioned. It says Yom Kippur is not going to be Mechaper until Ad Shirat says Chavero. And it quotes this Pasuk. So he suggests there's two different dinim in asking for Mechila. That in Bava Kamma it's talking about that point that we mentioned before about being able to press charges, that a human victim can press charges against you and you need to get him to drop the claim. And the Mishnah in Yuma from our Parsha, that's talking about something else. That's saying that a Kadosh Baruch Hu declares that he is also a victim whenever there's a Ben Adam L'Chavero offense, because every Ben Adam L'Chavero is at once an offense, Ben Adam L'Makom and Ben Adam L'Chavero, because you have the human victim, and the Kadosh Baruch Hu told you not to do it. So it's offense against God and offense against man. And God is saying, I'm not going to be mochel you unless you go through this process of the Tanai and the Kapara, you have to go through the Bakashas Mechila. So he basically understands that, we said before, is it a means to an end or is it the process itself? So he understands that for the Ben Adam L'Makom, the process itself is part of the Kapara. And for the Ben Adam L'Chavero, it's about the me, it's about actually obtaining the Mechila. So this could shed a different light, as he points out, on another detail. We've discussed this in the past in a different context. So one of the indications that it's about the process and not about the result is that there is a din that if you ask Mechila three times and the victim doesn't want to give it, so then you're off the hook. So this, it's not like to do an elementary school, it doesn't mean you machme, 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 okay, done. It means that you have to ask three separate occasions, and you have to ask three separate times, three separate ways. Try to do whatever you can in order to get the Mechila. So what kind of a din is that, that if you ask three times, then you're off the hook? It doesn't apply in any other area of life. Right? If you ask your father if you want to borrow his car, and he says, you ask him three times, and he says no three times, doesn't turn into a yes. That's not how it works. Right? And it's the opposite. It turns into losach mode, maybe. It turns into, if you keep asking, if you get a no, it doesn't, halacha doesn't recognize that as a yes. It recognizes that as probably its own aveira. So why should it be that if you ask, or something like that, and I'll take a question in a second, so but why should it be that in this area of life, if you ask three times, then you're done? So it could be that if the focus is on the process, so then we could understand it, that it's not really that you need to obtain his Mechila, it's that you need to go through the process that would normally obtain Mechila. So for the regular person, an average person, if he gets three requests, that'll be enough to give Mechila, and therefore you can use that as the barometer as to whether it was done right. But if after three times he's not being mochel, and it's something that he could be mochel, it's not, you don't have to mochel everything. There are aveiros that are too great for Mechila. But if it's something that's shayach to mochel, and he's not mochel after three times, so then that indicates that there is you've gone through the process properly. So Simcha Broi suggests an interesting idea. He says there's two different dinim in that. So if you look in the Gemara in Yuma, so the Gemara says that Rav Chanina was angry at Rav, I think, and that Rav asked him for Mechila many, many times over the course of many years. So the Gemara says, well, what about this din? Do you only have to ask three times? So the Gemara says, Rav Ashayni. that for his Rebbe it's different. So Rashi says he was machmir for his Rebbe, that even though he only had to do it three times, but because it was his Rebbe, he went above and beyond. But the Rambam doesn't bring that in. He says three times it's enough and you're done. So the Kesef Mishnah says that what he means is, in terms of this Gemara about Rav Hashayni, that as far as Mechila is concerned, it's just three times. But because of Kvod HaRav, that he had a different consideration for his Rebbe, so that's why he was asking more than that. So the Slam Derech suggests that as far as the Din Ben Adam L'Makom, so then that's all about the process. So then you ask three times, that's enough, and there's no need to do anything more than that. But as far as the Din Ben Adam L'Chavero, so that you actually want to obtain the Mechila. So if that takes 100 times, that takes whatever it takes. That's what Rashi is saying, there's room L'Hachmir from that perspective. Or as the Rambam is saying, that it's a Din in the Kavod HaRav, that's the Ben Adam L'Chavero between the Talmud and the Rebbe. So that is Shaykh to keep going until you actually obtain it. But as far as the Din of our Pasuk from our Parsha, then you have to ask Mechila in a way that will satisfy the Ben Adam L'Makom. So that's about the process. And that's three times. It's an interesting idea. Hi.
Hi. Just quickly, could it be kind of a little bit along what you're saying, but more like a chazaka that the person has now, a chazaka that they're not going to forgive you, they're not going to be willing to hear you out?
You see, that could be. Then the question is, then what do you do? Right. So why does it let you off the hook? Even if that's true.
Maybe that's what the process is. Meaning,
right. So that still goes back to the same point.
Right.
Right.
I'm
because
saying, could it be that the whole process.
Maybe, but the problem is the chazaka, it's not the usual relying on chazaka. So in other areas of halacha, when you say we rely on a chazaka, it means the chazaka tells us what we need to know, so we don't have to go further to, you know, if talking about checking letters or something like that.
I was thinking more like muad.
Right, so that also makes it bad. You know, the muad means that when a shor acts this way three times, so then we know that he's a violent shor.
The person, if he's acting like this, if he's not being, you know, listening to someone who actually wants to forgiveness, then three times under, like, I was thinking maybe more.
The question is, what does that do for us? So let's say we label him as a non-forgiver.
That says that person is on himself. It's no longer.
Because therefore he absorbs the Avera because of that? So you have to move to that step and say that because of his status as a non-forgiver, which is an issue to explore in general, that it seems like the obligation of Mechila really does go in both directions. That the Mishnah says, also in Bava Kamma, that a person should not be an achzar and refuse to give Mechila when it's shaykh. And the Yerushalmi has a different gear, so a person shouldn't be a rasha, that you assume that there is an avera involved. So that's why some of the Rishonim have tshuvas about, let's say, if somebody takes a shvua not to forgive somebody, so that happens here, people get very angry and they say, take a shvua, they're never going to forgive this guy. So maybe that shvua should not be effective because you'll say it's a shvua against the Torah. So maybe if it's an avera not to forgive, so then maybe the shvua shouldn't be effective. They also talk about what happens, this also comes up. You know, if you have families that are in a feud, so the parents say to the kids, you're not allowed to ever forgive that guy. So we know Kibud Av Aim doesn't apply if the parents give an instruction against the Torah. So the post can talk about whether that's considered to be an Aveira or not. So you could understand the whole thing as all being one process. That if Mechila is about fixing relationships, so really the chiyuv goes in both directions. It's the same idea that the avarian has to ask for mechila, and the nifka has to grant it, and that it's all two halves of the same coin, that it's a chiyuv that goes in both directions. So what you're suggesting, I guess, is that if the nifka is not going to do his part, he's not going to be mochel, so then he becomes the one who's responsible for this whole problem. So the same issue that was created by the avarian is now created by him. Maybe. Could be. Okay. So so with that, so let's now move to Pesach for a few minutes. So I'll just try to address a couple of points that were asked, and I wanted to say a little bit more about Persumei Nisa. We won't be able to say everything. There's a lot more one could say about Persumei Nisa, but I'll try to address just a little bit more about Pesach, especially in a way that draws on what we talked about earlier in the year about Hanukkah, so that we'll have a little bit of synergy between our Hanukkah learning and a Pesach learning. So, okay, so some of the questions just quickly that were asked was asked about the kidneys and quinoa, that hot topic. So, as you know, the Ashkenazim of a minig, not to eat kidneys on Pesach. It's a restricted minig. We don't treat kidneys like chametz. which means that it is subject to bittul. It's not aser bahana. It's not aser ba'yira ba'yimatze. It's just aser in a very limited sense, mikoach minig. But we do take menhagim very seriously, so therefore the assumption is that it's still binding. And even though it was a controversial minig, even among the Ashkenazim, Rabbi Yaakov Emden, probably most famously in his Moruk Tziyah, so he declared that he wants to do war on Kitnias. I think there is a website called the Kitnias Liberation Front. But the problem is, you might say, if you want to liberate the kidneys, then Dafka should not eat them, should set them free. It's like Rav Dessler says, right? Rav Dessler says, if you say you love fish, then why do you eat it? You know, if you love it, you're going to let it go free. So you don't really mean you love fish. It means that you love yourself and you like eating fish, so therefore you love eating fish. But in any event, so you could liberate them and set them free. But as far as eating them, so far the Ashkenazim have still maintained the minhag not to eat them. But it's always been a debate. It's always been a controversy. There's really room to wiggle as far as it's concerned. So the Rishonim and the later Svarim basically give three reasons why this is. That either it's because they were concerned that there may be actual chametz grains mixed in with the crops that are kitnios, that's been the case, that the kitnios were developed in areas where chametz grains are also, and we're worried about what's going to be mixed in. So that comes up as manazeh also, that we should carefully check, even if something is decided to be acceptable, but it has that chash, you have to be careful to check that that's not the case. The flip side of that is you also find the concern that maybe your actual chametz grains will not grow properly, and maybe they will look like the kidneys. So therefore, if you're in the practice of eating the kidneys, you'll come to eat this also, and maybe we should worry about that. The other consideration you find is that there was a practice in various places, various kidneyous items were essentially turned into bread. And that wouldn't be chametz, it would be kashrut Pesach bread, but the concern is that people will get confused and think, okay, so that guy is actually eating bread, and oh, apparently they changed things. Apparently you're allowed to eat bread nowadays. And if you think that's too far-fetched, people are able to believe anything, and that's a concern that somebody might come to that belief. And therefore, certain items that were associated with making bread had a prohibition associated with it. So essentially, the question becomes, so within that conception of kidneys, for whatever reason, so do you say that, so we try to figure out nowadays what would have been included in such a practice, and so if you have something like quinoa, which is this very popular food item, and apparently has a lot of protein in it, and some people think it's delicious, and some people think it's awful, it's clearly a matter of subjective assessment, but there are people who are very, it's clear there are definitely a lot of people who are very interested in quinoa, so should that be viewed as something that would have been included had it been around where the minhag was being formed, which is very likely the case, because apparently you can use it for everything. You could use it to make quinoa bread or whatever it is. So then it is credible to say that had quinoa been around, it would have been a candidate for kidneys. So nowadays, if we don't have a tradition that it's been included in kidneys, do we say, well, but we still fit it into the existing categories? Or do we say, like Rav Moshe said about other things, that we don't add on to it, we have the minig as it is, and ein lo elo chidusho, basically, that we don't look to expand it beyond its parameters, because there are other things, like potatoes are used to make bread also, and you could have easily said that potatoes should be kidneys, but that don't start that one, right? That right, so that's, so we don't... Right, so we don't want to get involved with that. So clearly there are foods that could have made a good case to be kidneys, but it doesn't have a tradition as such, so that's not the practice. So too, something that wasn't associated with the tradition not to eat it should be treated the same way. So that's basically a ongoing machlokas haposkim. So for example, today, so Rav Asher Weiss was machmir on quinoa, and Rav Belsky, who was machmer on the quinoa, and others were mekel, so Rav Shechter was mekel, and that creates the machlokas within the OU. So OU has gone back and forth, and the current practice is to, this year, is to allow the quinoa, and that's a subject to basically these two tzadim. Do you say that, well, we should try to figure out what the minig would have included if it had been around, or do you say, no, the minig is limited to its scope that it exists, and we don't have a reason nowadays to add other things into it, and if we did, that would really be quite a floodgate, because who knows what other things could end up being added in it as well. Comment?
Supposing that you would allow to eat quinoa and pesto, what would be the deal about using it for matzah?
No, so it's definitely not going to be... right, in general, the rule is chametz and matzah are, you know, bad guy, arch enemies of each other, you know, the opposite number. So that the only thing that can be chametz is that which can be matzah, and vice versa. That only that which can be chametz can be matzah. So if something is not actual chametz, then also can't turn into matzah.
Meaning it's not even grain.
Right, it's also a discussion. Right, so how should that factor into it? That's also some debate as to how exactly to classify it and whether or not the classification makes such a difference as far as whether it should be considered kidneyous. Whether it's considered chametz, that would make a big difference. Whether kidneyous is subject to a certain taxonomical definition is also subject to discussion. Okay, so more to talk about. There was questions about Chol HaMoed yesterday. So that's just to say very briefly, because I do want to say a little bit more about the Persimei Nisim. So Chol HaMoed, in general, there's a prohibition of Malacha on Chol HaMoed as well. It takes on a different form than the Yisr Malacha we've been talking about this whole year in terms of Shabbos. That basically it means that we should not do things that are not Litzara Chol HaMoed, particularly if they are a Maisa Uman. If they are something that is skilled labor, that's not just Maisa Hedget, that's not your basic everybody kind of thing, but it has some fanciness to it. So if it's not a Davar HaAvod, as the Gemara says in Moed Kadin, or it's not the Litzara HaMoed, so then we shouldn't do it. So the question is, what's considered Maisa Uman and what's considered Maisa Hedget? So, for example, or specifically, I think this is what was asked about yesterday, so typing on a computer, so how do we view that? So it's a little bit of a machlokas, because on the one hand, it's easy to do, especially nowadays, everybody does it, so it's easy to do from that perspective, which would be considered a maisa hedget. But as far as the product that's created, so it creates a nicer final product, so that maybe that looks like a maisa uman. So that was a little bit of a machlokas haposkim, how to view it. But again, if it's done for the purposes of something for yatif, or done for a davar avid, which as the Taz and others point out, it was machlokas rishonim on this point, but many assume that divrei Torah, by their very nature, are davar avid. You'll forget it, or you'll lose time from learning later. So to be on the computer for the purposes of Divrei Torah should itself be mutter. And it's only when it's not Latzara Chamoed or Davar Avod that we have to figure out how to classify it. So then it's subject to a little bit of a machlokas. The Shemira Shabbos Kehilchasa, he quotes that Reb Shlomo Zalman also thought that if it was not for one of those purposes, that there's an additional issue in terms of typing on the computer by itself. The previous point I was saying is really in reference to printing it out. If you type on the computer and then print it out, so you have a beautiful final product, how should we view that? But if you're just typing on the computer without printing out, so that's not real ksiva, it's not going to last, so that's not really subject to that issue. But Reb Shlomo Zalman thought that if you're saving something to a disk, or to the hard drive, that maybe that's a concern of Bona. Although nowadays computers are set to automatically save everything, so I don't know if there's any difference between saving and not saving. I think anything you're going to write in the computer is saved by default, so I don't know exactly how to relate to that question. But he thought that was a consideration, and that you have to figure out exactly how to interpret that. But again, if you're typing Litzarech HaMoed, or Litzarech Debrei Torah, or Litzarech HaSamadha, Davar HaAvod, so then there is what to work with as far as that's concerned.
Sorry, yeah. When it's Maisa Hedyo, you have to figure out if it's Litzarech HaMoed, or
So then, yeah, for Maisa Hedyo, you don't really have to, you don't really have that issue.
So could you, I mean...
It's a little bit of a discussion.
When someone would have been making this ruling, computers might not have been around for that much longer. But nowadays, just about everything is computerized, everything, from your phone to your tablet.
Right, but he's worried about this additional issue of Bona. I don't know exactly how it factors in, especially with the default saving. I'm not sure exactly how to assess that. But in any event, let's just, before we run out of time, I just want to say a few words about the Persimei Nisa of dalet kosos, and especially to contrast it or to build on what we talked about in the context of Hanukkah. So we spoke about, I think we mentioned this a little bit the other day, but when we talked about Hanukkah, so we saw there is a din that the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch say that one has to go to great lengths to light Neres Hanukkah, and you have to be shol apsachim ochres ksusot. If you can't afford Neres Hanukkah, you have to do whatever it takes, even if that means you have to go begging, even if that means you have to sell your clothes, whatever it takes, that's what you have to do in order to light Neres Hanukkah. And the question is, where does that come from? So the Magen Mishnah says it comes from a Mishnah in Psachim in the context of the Dalet Kosos, as we alluded to a little bit the other day, that Dalet Kosos, the Mishnah tells us that even if somebody is taking from tzedakah for his yantif meals, afilu ani halokeach min atamchoi lo yifchas lo midalet kosos shel yayin, he shouldn't have less than 4 cups of wine, he should take tzedakah to cover that as well. So it sounds like, even though normally for mitzvahs you're not obligated to go begging for tzedakah, the Gemara says in Ksubis, in the context of tzedakah, which the Ramah then applies to mitzvah saseh, that you're not obligated to spend more than a fifth of your money. So if mitzvahs are too expensive, you can't afford a little of an eserik, so you're pater. So when it comes to dalet kosos, you should have thought the same thing. But apparently no, as the Gemara later explains, that that's because of the Pursuma Nisa component. So says the Magid Mishnah in Hilchos Chanukah, there you have it, that this is the din by dalet kosos, you have to go begging, kol shekein, l'ner Chanukah. So there's two interesting points to focus on, which I'd like to just try to talk about for a few minutes. First of all, what's the kol shekein? That's as the Lecha Mishnah asks on the Kesef Mishnah. So okay, let's say them both. Let's say that Chanukah and dalet kosos are in the same category. So they're both pursuing these, so they have the same din. What's the kal v'chomer? And also, second point I want to get to is, there are other svarim that bring different makoros for this din by Chanukah. And one could argue if really that's the only way to read the Mishnah as far as dalet kosos are concerned. So let's try to quickly address both those two points. So in terms of a kal v'chomer to Chanukah, so there are a couple of suggestions. Why should it be a kol shekein? Why shouldn't we just say it's the same? So some say that the issue is one of numbers, which is interesting, that Chanukah is for the whole world. So you'll put the candle in the window, everyone will see it. And dalet kosos is just for your table. So therefore, it's more limited. So therefore, if you're going to go to such lengths to do dalet kosos for your table, so kal v'chomer for Chanukah, you should, all the more so. Which is a very interesting idea. Because you would think that Pursumei Nisa is its own chashiva, so it's not going to become more or less vital based on how many people are going to see it. But the Avnei Nezer has a similar svara, because the Avnei Nezer, in general, we've quoted him in the past, just focusing on the end part, the Avnei Nezer says that the chumra of Pursumei Nisa, I think we alluded to this the other day, is not because it's more important, it's because it's more urgent, in the sense that you can't skip out on it. That when it comes to other mitzvos, so we could say, onus rachmana patre, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will credit you for your desire to do a mitzvah. But when it comes to a mitzvah that involves other people, so then you have to actually get it done, because they're not going to see it, it's not going to have its effect. So in the context of saying that vort, the Avnei Nezer says that you could ask the following question, that the Gemara says that dalet kosos, Chanukah is more chamer than Kiddush because of the concept of Pursumei Nisa. So why don't you say that Kiddush is also Pursumei Nisa, because Kiddush declares God's creation of the world, Briyas HaOlam. So isn't that also Pursumei Nisa? Shouldn't we talk about that? So says the Avnei Nezer, yeah, it is. But Kiddush you can make by yourself. So there's no other person involved. So it's not as urgent. But once there's other people involved, so then they can't read your mind. You have to actually do it. So Kiddush you could do by yourself. Dalet kosos is for your household, because he says, if you got it to Lubincha, so you have to actually communicate to other people. And Chanukah is all the more so, is to the whole world, so that becomes even more of a rush. Hi.
But you could do dalet kosos by yourself. ask the questions to yourself.
Right, but that's clearly very b'dieved, right? Because that whole point that you're asking yourself, it already highlights the fact that really you should be interacting with somebody else. So in the perfect surah of the mitzvah, it's going to involve interacting with somebody.
But I'm saying you could. I mean, there's a possibility.
Except that you'd have to assume that you're lacking something very fundamental in that case. So you also have to consider, and this is an interesting point to think about in general, that some of the Achronim say, the Tshuvas Knaf Renana and others talk about this, and they assume that when it comes to Dalet Kosos, it's less urgent than Hanukkah, because Hanukkah, the whole mitzvah is Neris Hanukkah. So the whole Prasuminis of Hanukkah comes from Neris Hanukkah. But when it comes to Pesach, so we have a lot of things going on. We have the matzah and the maror and the haggadah and all of that. And Dalet Kosos is one component. So if you don't have Dalet Kosos, it's not like your Pesach Nisa will be nothing. You'll have all the other things that will affect Pesach Nisa. Even though, as others far point out, but you don't find the din of Shol Al Pesachim by these mitzvahs. So maybe you'll end up with nothing. Unless you assume that matzah, for example, that's the ikar of the meal. So by definition, everyone's going to ask for tzedakah for that, because otherwise they're not eating. So you don't have to be told that you have to ask for tzedakah for your basics of the meal, which will include matzah, but Dalet Kosos maybe you would have done without. But in any event, it does prompt the question, so why did Chazal bother with Dalet Kosos? Why was that so necessary? That when it comes to Hanukkah and Purim, so we wouldn't have anything otherwise. So Chazal made institutions of Pesach Nisa, of Megillah reading and Hanukkah reading. But the Hanukkah lighting. But when it comes to the Seder, so we have so much else going on, so why did Chazal need to make an institution of Dalet Kosos Bechlal? Vitaka would have had a lot of Pesach Nisa without it. So you have to assume that Dalet Kosos represent some idea which is not present in all the other mitzvos of the night, which you have to figure out exactly what it is. I was thinking that this maybe is a little bit better for the other tzad that we were saying the other day than we're talking in general about Dalet Kosos, whether it's a mitzvah to drink for Kosos, or whether it's an idea that the mitzvos halayla of speech, those four mitzvos, should be done ala kos. So if it's the second one, maybe we could understand it a little bit better, that it's not pshat that Chazal wanted specifically to add in a new person to everything else going on the night. It's just that once these mitzvos were being done anyway, so it was necessary that they be done in a way that fully shows cheirus, and that means ala kos. But we're not for the fact that there were other mitzvos that were accompanying the kosos, it wouldn't necessarily have been required to have an institution of Dalet Kosos on top of everything else, perhaps. But it's also interesting, so there are other svarim, like we said, that have different makoros for them by Hanukkah, and they don't assume that the Mishnah about Dalet Kosos is the source. So it's possible that one could read the Mishnah more literally without putting the Magen Mishnah's construction on top of it, and say that it doesn't really mean that anyone has to go begging for Dalet Kosos. It means that the tzibor has to provide the Dalet Kosos, but if the tzibor doesn't, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to go begging. It's a din in the tzibor that they have to provide it. So that's an interesting idea, that if that's the case, why should that be? Why should it be that the tzibor has to provide this specifically, and that it's a mitzvah on them? So I think there's two ways you could suggest. One, again, to parallel strongly an idea that we found in Hilchos Hanukkah, is that we could say that Pesach Nisa is different from other mitzvahs in a different way. That other mitzvahs are personal obligations. So tefillin, lulav, esrog, those are personal obligations. So if somebody can't afford them, so they're pater. So if somebody else wants to give tzedakah, so you have to give tzedakah to people who need food, who need sustenance. And people's performance of mitzvahs are not necessarily prioritized because that's not a physical need and the individual is pater. But when it comes to Pesach Nisa, Pesach Nisa is all about the impact, is all about how it's being publicized. So maybe your achrayus towards Pesach Nisa is not only towards your own Pesach Nisa, that if you can make sure that others can also perform Pesach Nisa, that all goes to your own efforts towards Pesach Nisa. And therefore you could say, we had a similar shaila when it comes to Hilchos Hanukkah, just to draw the parallel, that the question came up that, let's say you have enough oil to light Mahadran, and your friend doesn't have any oil at all. So you could give him some of your oil so that he could light the Ikar Mitzvah, and then you'll both do the Ikar Mitzvah, and you'll sacrifice your Mahadran. So in general, it's a shaila achronim have, when you have a decision like that, so you could do a Mitzvah Mahadran, or you could do a Mitzvah Behidr, but your friend won't be able to do it at all, so should you sacrifice your hiddur for other people? for other people's basic mitzvah. So that's a shaila in general, b'chol Torah kula. When it comes to Hanukkah, you could say it's different for two reasons. You could say that the hiddur is more important to hold on to because the hiddur is different than other mitzvahs built into the mitzvah itself. Or you could say, some achronim say the opposite way, that by Hanukkah, there's more of an idea you should give up to the other guy. Because maybe the Pursumei Nisa is not just that you should do it, but you should make sure that as many households as possible have Ner Chanukah. So if you could enable a different house to have Ner Chanukah that wouldn't otherwise, maybe that's a higher priority than you're doing the mitzvah in a state of hiddur. So maybe that's what the din of the Mishnah is, that there is a responsibility that everyone who's willing should be partaking in Pursumei Nisa, and therefore the tzibur has to worry that everyone should have this component as part of their Seder, even if they otherwise don't take it as an achrayis to provide tefillin for everyone to provide lulav and esrog. That's not necessarily the same type of responsibility, but a mitzvah that's about Pursumei Nisa, they have to make sure that that's everywhere. And maybe it could also suggest that perhaps when it comes to Pesach, so this is particularly within the Pursumei Nisa of Pesach, that the notion, as we alluded to the other day, and this is perhaps another example of it, but that taking care of those in need is particularly woven into the fabric of Pesach specifically. And the Torah actually quotes an idea from his brother that Pesach represents Avraham Avinu, that Avraham was the Amad HaChesed, so Pesach is about Chesed. And that along those lines, the Chafetz Chaim in a Sefer Avos Chesed, so he quotes from the Tanya de Baal Yo, that the zchus that got the Jews through the Golos is that they made a pact with each other. They said things are getting very bleak, we're in trouble, but the only way we'll be able to cope is if we take care of each other and we decide that whatever little bit we have, we'll share and we'll make sure that everyone else has in order to be taken care of. So that zchus, that pact of Chesed, it was that that got the Jews through, and that was the zchus that allowed us to be redeemed. So Baruch Emulsion, who we mentioned many times in the Sfarim on Chanukah. So he has two volumes, one that I'm aware of. He has a volume on Chanukah and a two volume set on Pesach. Beautiful, beautiful volumes in both cases. So in his essays on Pesach and the Sichos on Pesach, so he has some very nice Sichos about this idea, and he suggests that the recitation of Halach Ma'anya and the recitation of Kol Dichvan Yesei V'Yechol that we say, everyone always asks, you know, how sincere is an offer? How sincere of an offer is this? That it's unlikely that somebody who needs a meal happens to have his ear pressed against your door so he can hear you say, Kol Dichvan Yesei V'Yechol, and he'll throw open the door and say, I was waiting for that, now I can come and join your suda. So presumably if it was really a sincere offer, you'd have to extend it before the meal. So he suggests that the recitation of Kol Dichvan Yesei V'Yechol is itself kind of a pirsum hanes. It's kind of a declaration that just like our forefathers in Mitzrayim, that's what they did, that with their little lach ma'anya, they made sure that everyone had, even though they didn't have so much to go around. So too, that's the midah that we try to emulate today. So maybe we could say that making sure that Tzibur has a dalet kosos, even those who are not able to provide for themselves, that itself is part of the pirsum hanes of Pesach, and that itself goes to the very root of what Pesach is about. So on that note, I wish everyone a wonderful Yontif, a Yontif of Chesed, a Yontif of Geula. It should be a time of bracha, and I look forward to seeing you when we come back. Dov, would you like to down for us? Okay, Ashrei Yashiv Yisaf, Rajiv 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 Yisaf,